Welcome back, everyone. So thank you very much, Richard. There's a load of questions coming in. And so we'll start off with this. Is there a difference between wealth and profit?
So you probably can't. Well, yes and no is the answer. You probably, if you have no profit at all, ever, you probably ultimately are not going to generate wealth. However, for an individual, in an individual setting, of course, then it is possible to accumulate some personal capital, even if a individual business or enterprise isn't profitable. But on the macro level, you ultimately have to have profit in order to generate value added, I suppose is the way I'd put it, to generate wealth that is going to make a difference to society by adding to the sum total of the wealth. So I don't think it's exactly the same, but I do think it's related. And interestingly, some of the criticisms of markets and some of the criticisms of capitalism come from extreme examples of profit, perhaps when profit becomes exploitation. And in economic terms, you can have sort of certain expressions of profit, monopoly profit, for example, which I don't think we would wish to defend from a Christian perspective.
When we create wealth, are we not imitating God's creative character in making something out of what did not exist?
I think we are doing exactly that. I think that is exactly part of that. I mean, in a sense, that is part of the reason I based a lot of what I said on the Genesis narratives. And going back to last month, we are, you know, the divine sort of mandate to work comes from the fact that God himself is creative. And when we get to talk about enterprise and entrepreneurship, we'll be saying a lot more about what does that creativity mean? What does that innovation mean? But these are part of God's essential character, so they're important points.
Great. Could you point us to the scriptural basis for the divine imperative for private property?
Yes, I can do that in a whole number of places. There are a whole series of sort of lectures and talks you can give on private property, but for example, if you go to Genesis 4, right at the beginning of the scriptures, you see that in Genesis 4, right at the beginning, in the first couple of verses, you have Abel as a keeper of sheep, Cain a worker of the ground. You have all of those examples, I can't remember all the verses here, of the way in which flocks were seen as the blessing that was given by God. We see examples in the New Testament. I gave one example of Lydia and her and Lydia being the owner of property, and so on and so forth. So those things were seen as normative. I guess if you're going to challenge that, where people sometimes look for a challenge is the old chestnut of Acts 2. So Acts 2, 42 to 44. Let me get to the right place here. 42 to 47. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. Awe came upon every soul. Many wonders and signs were being done through the apostles, and all who believed were together and had all things in common. And they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they received their food with glad and generous hearts. So there's two things there. Firstly, is this a version of Christian communism? Almost certainly not. Partially because clearly the property was retained. And so when it says they were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing, that clearly wasn't a required mandate. It was clearly something that was done at that point in order to meet social need within the church. And you'll know from two or three chapters verse on the role of the deacons in providing for social welfare. John Wesley wrote about those verses and said that he thought it was wonderful. And for the first few years of his Christian ministry, he said he tried to implement those verses. And it lasted a matter of a few weeks. And he said it's completely unworkable. It doesn't work like that. Therefore, they can't quite mean what some people think they mean. I think those verses are about the proper provision of social need within the context of the church. Sorry, I went on a little bit from the private property question, but various examples of private property you could give from the scriptures.
Do not steal helps as well on that.
Absolutely, the commandments. Do not covet, you know.
Could Richard provide a biblical example of someone who, whilst working hard, is criticized for not doing enough to generate wealth? I'm struggling to see examples of wealth generating work being prioritized rather than just work versus laziness.
I think the proper answer to that would be that if you are working in, as opposed to being lazy, if you are working in accordance with the divine mandate, you will be contributing to the creation of wealth. So let's think of examples in today's world. I don't think the creation of wealth is the preserve of people involved in business. I think we all contribute to the creation of wealth through our everyday work, whatever that work is, including the work of a minister, but not exclusive to that. Some people have particular responsibilities when it comes to capital and the allocation of capital, the investment of capital, and the generation of capital. But we all contribute to the creation of wealth through our everyday work. We do it partially because we receive some remuneration for it, and we do it partially because we contribute to a bigger whole. So I wouldn't want to draw too great a distinction between, well, there's some work that creates wealth and some that doesn't. Because if you think some work doesn't, ignoring laziness, if you think some work doesn't contribute to wealth, that doesn't sit very easily with the divine command to work. So I would say all work contributes in some way, but not identically and not the same, hence the parable of the talents.
Do you think then non-profit enterprise is fulfilling the creation mandate?
Yes, I do. I don't think it's the only thing. And I think if we only had not-for-profit enterprise, that could be problematic. But I mean, let's take my own organization, which is a charity and it's a think tank. We employ 2.5 people. So we're not big, but we employ 2.5 people. So we provide employment. We're supported by the donations of Christian people, but we employ those people. Those people get salary. They then contribute to the society in which they live. So I think sort of not for profit is a perfectly reasonable expression of work. I don't think it's the heart of the beating heart of the economy. And I don't think that you could exist solely on not for profits. But I think it's part of the rich tapestry, the rich mixture.
How should we respond when market forces and capitalism create unethical situations which hurt and damage others?
Yes, we should. We as Christians believe in honesty and transparency. And so clearly we should expect ethical behavior to be... I think we're able to be discharged in God's economy, in God's created world. And it is perfectly reasonable for those failures to be held to account, and right and proper that they are, both individually and in terms of the law of the land and so on and so forth. So, for example, let's take an easy example of fraud. If somebody commits a fraud, then it's a perfectly right and proper Christian response that individual should be both held to account by God, but also held to account by the law of the land. Interestingly, if you go back to the 19th century, the Quakers, who then were Christian, by the way, the Quakers in the 19th century, they threw you out if you went bankrupt in your business because of the damage it did to the reputation and moral standing of the Christian community. Interesting.
Yeah.
So I don't want anyone to interpret what I'm saying as some sort of unlimited endorsement of the market in the sense that the market is God. I don't think the market is God. I think God is God. And I think he has provided the market as part of that provision, and that we're called as Christians to bring God's values and God's behaviors and God's ethics to that market.
Well, Christian, how would you talk with a Christian who believes any differential outcomes must be down to injustice?
I'd be very kind and generous to them, and then explain they were misguided. if you want a bit of controversy, I mean, I would be very kind and generous, because Christians adopt different views on different things. But the cold reality is, I spent my whole life studying the history of the Christian church and Christian theology and all the rest of it. And the reality is the overwhelming majority, not all, the overwhelming majority of Christians have, for the most part of Christian history, identified with the market and the voluntary principle. There are always nuances, and of course there are always people who take a slightly different view. There is a minority view which emerged mostly in the latter part of the 19th century, at which time it was seen as, in today's theological terms, ultra-liberal. One may put it that way, this Christian socialism, effectively, but which in the 20th century seems to have captured a significant portion of British evangelicals. So I am acknowledging that there seems to have been that shift, but that's not historically accurate, and that's not historically the case. And so to the Christian who came to me and said, you know, come on, this is all the fault of injustice, I would listen to them. I would take them seriously. I would ask them to explain their examples. And then I would explain that perhaps what we see as injustice may involve some elements of personal responsibility. What we see as injustice may not be the injustice necessarily. So, for example, I don't consider inequality to be injustice. I don't think the Bible has promised us equality. Whereas I do have some friends who would think any inequality is, by definition, an injustice. And I don't think looking after my family and providing for my family is anything other than just and moral. And if the government overtaxes me and removes an excessive amount of the remuneration that accrues to me, that damages my ability to provide for and look after my family. So where's justice in that? Now, I say that slightly starkly just to make the point. If you go back to the great Quaker businessmen of the 19th century, the Cadburys and the Roundtrees, you see, today the Quakers would be very much in the category you've just described. You know, it's all the problem of injustice and all that. But Cadbury and Roundtree passionately wanted to do good in their communities, passionately wanted to bring about the relief of poverty. So what did Cadbury do? He didn't say, let's increase taxes. He says, let's come together and provide some housing that the workers at my factory can access. He didn't give it to them. But he gave them access to housing through mortgages to enable the workers to purchase their own properties. That seems like quite a good idea to me, and that would seem like quite a just response. So I think injustice must, of course, be called out, but I think injustice is sometimes used as an excuse.
Are CEO packages in millions of pounds and dollars unethical?
They may be or they may not be. I'll give a defense and then I'll give a criticism. I personally think it's an enormous distraction. So the number of people in the UK, let's just take the UK, the number of people in the UK who earn in excess of £1 million is actually a tiny, tiny, tiny number of people. And I'm not sure it's healthy to become over obsessed with those tiny number of people. CEOs can be the average length of tenure of a CEO is 3.5 years. So you might be paid very well for those 3.5 years. There's lots of other thing issues that generates, but for those 3.5 years, but you've got very few guarantees. It may be that you bring particular skills to the business. It may be that you're being rewarded for success. I don't see anything wrong with those things. Now, I am much more negative about being rewarded for failure. I'm much more negative about what the economists would call rent extraction, where the only reason you've got your millions is you've been able to extract it out of the business in a way driven almost entirely by self advancement and greed. So I wouldn't endorse that remotely. Do I think that the answer to that lies in state interventions? Absolutely not. The answer to that lies in the proper management of company, the proper investment of capital, and the proper exercise of corporate governance, all of which would be good Christian things to do.
What areas do you see today that could be the equivalent of Shaftesbury's voluntary societies for the good of society?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I've become very positive, more positive over time towards social enterprise. So a social enterprise, many of you will know, but it's basically an organization, a charitable company set up to achieve social good, but on commercial terms, but not necessarily making the maximum amount of profit, usually turning a profit in order to generate the investment and so on, but not making the maximum amount of profit. I know examples of that in relation to prisons. I know examples of that in relation to helping offenders. And I think there are good examples of social enterprise. I know one investment company that seeks to generate social investment bonds, so bring capital together in order to assist social enterprises. I think the Shaftesbury's of this world would be really passionate about the sort of the social enterprise model as a way of putting the old voluntary society example into practice today. Another interesting thing, I mean, I haven't fully thought this one out. Another interesting thing is in the whole relation to housing. So Shaftesbury was the president of the, I can't remember the name, some grand Victorian name, it was like the Battersea Artisans 4% Dwellings Company or something. And basically, they built 80,000 houses in London. So these were affordable homes, but they were built on commercial terms. And the investors took a slightly less than maximum return. They took 4%. They didn't take 6%. And I think we may have lost sight again because of the growth of the state. I mean, I apologize. I realize I've got a little bit of a bee in my bonnet about the growth of the state, but it's an enormous growth over the last 100 years. I think one of the consequences of that is that some of the creativity and innovation that comes from some of these alternative ways of approach are lost. I think where you need the state, and this is the problem of the voluntary society, I guess. So the voluntary society has a great advantage of locality, but the disadvantage of scale. And that's where you get that sort of tension.
If inequality is a fact of life, how then should I live and respond to it as a Christian?
I believe as Christians we have a social responsibility to assist people in need. I don't think that's an unusual or a strange thing to say. And I think as church communities we have some responsibility to help those of our members who are in need, and probably further than that, contribute to helping those in need in society. But you know, an industry has arisen, which one might call the poverty industry. And if you constantly redefine what poverty is in relative terms, then indeed you will always have the poor with you. And I think the Christian responsibility is to deal with absolute poverty, to deal with people in need, to help in those circumstances. It's not to reduce inequalities per se. And so, for example, I think is it the Roundtree Trust? I hope I'm not doing them a disservice. I think it's the Roundtree Trust defines poverty as 60% of average earnings. Well, everyone you will always have a significant proportion of the population in poverty if you define it in those terms. So I think our Christian commitment is to people in need. We don't want people to starve. We don't want people to, you know, have no roofs over their heads, to freeze. We have a social responsibility in that regard. But I don't think we have a social responsibility just to crank people's incomes up to some predetermined figure. Sorry, that's probably controversial, but I think that the issue of relative versus absolute poverty is a very big distinguishing matter that causes a lot of discussion and debate.
This might well be controversial. What are your thoughts on the furlough scheme and the fact that it potentially encourages state dependence?
Oh, wow. That's the hardest question so far. So, I want to go back a step or two, because that's obviously a very pertinent question in relation to our current social economic circumstances. So as a Christian, I believe that the way in which national church leadership, and I emphasize that, I don't mean Paul, your pastor, I don't mean my local vicar, I don't mean the Baptist minister who's my friend down the road. I'm not talking about the individual leaders of local churches, but I think national church leadership has utterly spiritually failed to in the course of this pandemic. And they have utterly spiritually failed in a number of ways, one of which was the failure to defend the right of Christians to worship. Now, I add here that I'm as in favour as everybody else in people being kept safe. I think this disease is dreadful. I think it's fantastic that progress is being made. I will stick my arm out for the jab when I get the offer. Not going down conspiracy lines. Not going there. It's a dreadful disease, and there's an appropriate response in terms of protection of people. But that failure of national spiritual leadership has then become exemplified in our response to the economic circumstances. So not a single one of the government scientific advisors is going to lose their job because of this pandemic. Not one. Not a single civil servant will lose their post or even be placed on furlough because of the economic consequences of this pandemic. I think that completely distorts the picture of public policy making. C.S. Lewis in 1958 warned against the tyranny of government by scientists. I think there's lots of things we can celebrate about science, lots of things we can celebrate about the development of this vaccine. It's wonderful, it's marvellous, it's great. But the role of the scientist is not to govern. And it is for the government to assess what is the appropriate balance and trade-off between economic activity, economic well-being, national well-being, mental and emotional well-being, and all of the health challenges that we face. I'm sorry about the long preamble, but that means that I probably think in the first instance the use of the furlough scheme was probably inevitable and probably necessary. You might be surprised to hear me say that, but to begin with I think it was probably necessary and probably essential as a short-term temporary measure. And the issue with the furlough scheme is it cannot continue on and on if it is protecting jobs that don't really exist. And finally, and I'm sorry I've taken a long time to answer this question, and finally, you know, the costs of the furlough scheme building up in terms of national debt and sovereign debt is also a moral issue. And the quantity of sovereign debt that is generated and held by a state is an intergenerational issue. I pass it on to my children to fund from their taxes in their lifetime. And so we can't just say, you carry on doing furlough and run up an enormous sovereign debt and think there are no consequences. So I think it probably was inevitable that we had to use it. It was probably an economic masterstroke in the short term, but we have to come out of this lockdown and we have to come out into renewed economic activity. And I say that recognizing all of those points about the importance of keeping people safe and keeping people healthy.
Richard, there are other questions, but I think we're going to draw stumps there tonight. Thank you very, very much. It's really thought provoking. There may be you've got other questions that you'd like Richard to answer. Do email them in. So I think if those of you wanted to leave now, you could. I wouldn't mind just chatting with Richard for kind of 10 minutes on kind of social enterprise and what it looks like in a kind of London context. So if you wanted to stay and talk about that, you could. Do feel free to head off now, but we'll go for another 10 minutes. Richard, I wanted to ask you about, in our context in West London, in Ealing, property prices, it's very difficult for kind of youngish couples, families to stay long-term, even to get on the market. And so that people can put down roots, and that's likely to get harder as time goes on. And so a number of us have thought, how can we encourage families, people to stay long-term in communities?
Yeah.
What's the role of the church in that? What's the role of kind of Christians clubbing together, banks, Christians setting up loan? Have you got any help you could give us on that?
Some of that goes right to the heart of some of the things I'm really interested in from an academic point of view. And I'm, in fact, I was meant to write something about it today, but I got distracted by other things and we'll be writing about it tomorrow. But let me just go back one step. So next time I'm going to talk about call and vocation. And I will obviously locate most of that in relation to the call to business, because that's the topic that we're talking about. But call and vocation goes wider than the call to business, of course. And call and vocation goes across the whole of our lives, the whole of our everyday lives, the whole of our Christian lives, the whole of our spiritual lives, every aspect of that, including issues of where we choose to live. And I'm sort of relatively committed to the idea of the local church. When I say relatively committed, I've always understood people have reasons to go to some church somewhere, you know, and all the rest of it. I used to live in the centre of Oxford, I lived in that. The only reason I lived in the centre of Oxford wasn't because I had any money. It was because the house came with my job. Remember, in Oxford is the most expensive place to live outside of London. And in terms of multiples of income, it's worse than London. It's dire in that respect. And I lived in a nice house because I didn't have to pay for it. It was a terribly bad idea, but you know, I didn't have any choice. It came with my job. And when I went to church, I walked to church from my house. And when I changed my job and I moved 7-8 miles out of Oxford, I now live near Woodstock. About 6-7 miles north of Oxford, near Blenheim Palace, but not in the palace because I couldn't afford the electricity bill, you know, that sort of thing. But there were two issues that arose. Firstly, was I realised all the downside of not having had my own property. I now had to provide my own property in my early 50s, as it was then, or mid 50s, as it was then. And it was all very well to live in a house provided by your job, but actually it hadn't helped me at all. The second issue, which is the relevance to the question, Paul, is that, well, you know, am I going to get in the car and drive back to church in Oxford? And it was very tempting because the quality of the preaching was probably better from where we ended up going, apart from the weeks I preach, of course. But we decided what we needed to do was commit to our local community. And so we've been going to our local village church, and there's only 12 people who are turn up on a Sunday. But there are some spiritual diamonds among them. And there are some people who don't know Jesus, I think. And I realized there was an opportunity to make a difference by living, working, and, well, I have an office in Oxford for my day job, but living, working and operating within that local community. And that's been true during COVID. It's been true from a spiritual perspective, even though I'm attending a church where they've not had the tradition that I come from of the expository preaching, and I'm having to introduce, I only preach once a month just to help out the minister, and I'm gradually introducing those ideas to them. So I think the vocation to live and work and be committed in your local community is a good one. It's not going to be relevant for everybody, but it's a good one and we should encourage it. You then move to the next question of how do you make a difference? And so I think the social enterprise model is a really good way of being able to make a difference in a local community. Whether it's a credit union, whether it's a some form of, well, that would encourage thrift, wouldn't it? Some other way of encouraging thrift and prudence, whether it's a sort of food bank type sort of approach. I'm in favour of all these things. As local expressions of social justice by the Lord's people in the places where the Lord has set them. And I think a healthy church will have three things in its life. A healthy church will have an utter commitment to the preaching and proclamation of the scriptures, an utter commitment to bringing people to know and love Christ, and an utter commitment to well-being and the welfare of the communities in which they are set. And I think you get distortions of the Christian faith if you only have one of those. So if you only have the commitment to, you know, the commitment to social good, you end up in a sort of social gospel without anything else. But, you know, if you only think our calling is evangelism, you start having all sorts of implications for what is people's role in the world in which we live, what has God called us to do, what is the point of us being here. So my argument is you need all three. Sorry, that was another long-winded answer. I do apologise. I must get more succinct.
And so on kind of, you read the 19th century Shaftesbury and the men in starting kind of, so, the implications of the gospel forcing them to kind of start these social remarkable things, orphanages, there's more and more need of that. How do local churches, how do Christians do that? What's the role of the church? What's the role of the individual? Help us out.
So the interesting thing, isn't it, in these 19th century examples is that these were parachurch movements. So they were local but parachurch. So you think of something like the London City Mission, you think of something like the, well, it was then called the Ragged School Union in the 19th century sort of name. And what they did was bring churches together and groups of local churches together. And they also brought together, there was the things that came together were local churches in a sort of para church organization. But I have to say also philanthropists. People who did have some wealth, people who had got some capital, people who'd committed to give some of that wealth and capital for good and would give a portion of that to the support of these enterprises. So you get local, you get philanthropic investment, and you get a slightly wider umbrella. We don't have very much of a tradition of philanthropy in this country. One of the things I've learned from many years of visiting the States is a business, I nearly said a businessman, sorry, that's kind of my age, a business person in the States, male or female, it is inculcated in them from the beginning that part of their responsibility is to invest, educate and give a portion of their wealth. It's not something they have to be taught later in their life. Every single Christian business person I've met in America has it driven into them that they know they have to achieve some good with what's been entrusted to them. And it's a great model, and it would make an enormous difference here in what was possible and what could be achieved.
9:05, and thank you all for sticking with us. Thank you, Richard, very, very much. It's very helpful. And if you've got questions, thoughts, please do email them in. We'd love to hear them. If you've got ideas, and we can see to try and pick this up next time. But thank you very much, all of you, for joining.